We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Who's Counting, our podcast about all things elections, how elections are supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and all things about election integrity and how you and we as citizens can retake and reclaim our election systems. We're very honored today to have with us as our guest, the Honorable Claudia Tenney, who is the member of the United States House of Representatives from the 22nd District of New York. And Representative Tenney, we are thrilled that you could be with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's really an honor to be on, and this is such an important issue. So many things happening in our nation right now are so important, which is partly how I got involved in government in the first place as a small business owner from upstate New York. Never imagined I'd ever be doing what I'm doing today, but it's a real honor to serve my community, my state, and our nation. And there's just a lot that we need to do to restore our republic, and I'm committed to doing that. And I think we need strong people out there who are willing to take a lot of the heat that comes from the other side, a lot of misinformation. So it's great that we can set the record straight with your listeners.
Well, thank you so much, Congresswoman. I want to start with the fact that you served in the state legislature in the state assembly in New York for a number of years before you ran for Congress. You were elected in 2016 and served one term. And then what happened?
I actually am a lawyer who became a partner in my law firm many, many years ago in the 90s. And then I ended up running our family business, which was a newspaper, which is how I ended up getting a little bit involved in politics, something I never thought I'd do, although my parents were both involved and my grandparents. But, when 2016 rolled around, I was already a member of the state assembly. I first got elected in 2010. I defeated our local Republican county chairman.
Win the primary. Good for you.
I'd always have a primary. And until I was elected to Congress, I'd actually never been endorsed by our local party before an election or a primary. So, it's always been an uphill battle. And it's because New York is sort of unique. I mean, we're in a position where we're now one party rule, and we've been sort of heading that direction for a number of years. And, just as a business owner, really got involved in politics because I thought, well, these politicians keep telling us they're going to lower our taxes, they're going to help the small business community. And none of that ever came to fruition. We just got higher taxes, more regulations. And I even had a politician tell me, there's nothing we can do for you. You really just don't matter. And a former congressman said that my business was a Mickey Mouse operation.
Oh, wow.
We had 65 employees in one plant and 70 in another. And, we're providing millions in payroll and taxes and everything to the community. And so I thought, well, isn't that nice? I was like, well, someday, maybe I'll do that. And I ended up kind of, working as a chief of staff, legal counsel, part-time to the former assemblyman. That's when I ran it. And he retired and I ran in 2010. Then I got redistricted into the longest district created in New York State history. So they weren't had neither side had another primary, another general election. Neither side was too excited about it. And that's when I contemplated running for Congress at some point, really just to have a smaller district, because believe it or not, with only 134,000 people in my assembly district, the congressional district that I was in was actually shorter and less of a drive and less burdensome than my assembly district, which took me across 7 counties and 4 regions of New York State, almost to New York City, where my constituents commuted to New York City for their work. So way up from central New York, and where I actually border Congresswoman Elise Stefanik's district, which is all of the North Country of the Adirondack region of New York. So, but I decided to run for Congress. And then in 2016, I ran in 2014 in a primary against the incumbent, who was the only Republican in the House of Representatives to endorse Hillary Clinton. I came very close. I didn't win that primary, but I was outspent $3 million to $180,000 and really just had no resources. But I set the stage for running again in 2016, faced, two opponents in the primary. And I think that year they spent, my opponents had 16 million, maybe 13 or 16 million. And I had almost three by the end of the year, but nothing until September, really, when I finally won the primary and after I'd won the primary. But just say that the reason I'm giving you that backstage is because I've been involved in this election process and gerrymandering and a lot of these things that deal with our election process for a long time, even as a lawyer, as a candidate. And now here we are at another redistricting year. And in 16, it was really a challenging year. Obviously, I ran with President Trump in 2016, who, you know, it was great to serve. I won that race, a three-way primary, a three-way general against two, you know, all very wealthy people, putting mostly their own money in a lot of these races. Obviously, the DCCC helped some. But, you know, running with President Trump, serving that first term in the majority, which was, you know, really quite an amazing experience to do what we did. And to really, it was the first time we really helped our small business community in New York. It's just not much we can do on the state side. So we were able to get, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, where only 5% of my district even itemizes, so that the benefits to small businesses, individuals, you know, middle class and lower income taxpayers all benefited. So many great things we did for the country. And then in 2018, I just, you know, ended up with an opponent with, you know, another $15 million. And I narrowly lost that race. And so I wasn't going to run again, but I got urged by President Trump and others to try it again. So I ran in 2020. In what turned out to be the last called congressional seat, after experiencing about almost 100 days of counting in court, after I had been up over 28,000 votes on election night. So my experience in dealing with election integrity, particularly as you said at the top of the show, Mark Elias, the diabolical, I call him this sleazy vote trafficking lawyer, from the other side, who's been involved in races back in the Al Franken days, even. It's funny because one of his staff.
Right.
So, but I, you know, we looked Mark Elias in the eye, and we were able to defeat him, and went through quite an interesting experience over the 90 to 100 days of counting. And so that's how I just got involved in this election integrity, when I realized just all that I've been through. You know, I wanted to shed some light on it to make sure we know exactly what's going on and that the people aren't getting misinformation and distortions about what we can do, what we can't do, what the Democrats are peddling, and what's really happening in the election front. So with the Election Integrity Caucus, I co-founded it with Mike Garcia from California, who also won by a narrow margin in a tough state like California. And we've hosted all kinds of people to come on the show from all across the country to talk about their issues and what's happening in elections. And it's been really informative, and we've had a lot of members join us, and everything that we put forth, we encapsulate and send it out to the entire House representative and anybody else who needs this information, so that they know the kind of information we've gleaned from these experts and people who are actually, you know, state representatives, secretaries of state, a number of people. So it's really been, you know, a challenge. And now here we are, less than a year away from the midterm election. And we really need to redouble our efforts to make sure that we don't have any kind of nonsense that happened in the last presidential election occur again.
Well, one of the things that we've done here at the Conservative Partnership Institute, where I'm the senior legal fellow at CPI, and I run the Election Integrity Network that we created in 2021. And one of the things that we're really focused on is helping citizens understand their role in the election process, because states require that there be opportunities for citizen observers and transparency. There are opportunities for citizens to become election officials, election workers. One of the things that I found over many years of being an election attorney is that, despite the fact that most states require that there be parity between the parties in terms of who are the election officials, you have to have the equal number of Democrats and Republicans. In state after state after state, over many, many years, I've found that you have Democrats who are appointed to fill Republican slots. And the answer is always, well, we can't find enough Republicans to fill the Republican slots. So we're beginning to change all of that. But it has to happen at the local level. It has to have, people have to be engaged and involved at the very, grassroots, granular ground level. And I'm beginning to see, Congresswoman, a narrative that the left is beginning. I'm just seeing this. So this is something we should all put on our radar screens, that because of the work that we're doing through our Election Integrity Network with states and citizens across the country, and we're doing a lot. I'd be happy to share some of that with you. But one of the main things we're doing is insisting on getting citizens involved in those statutory positions that guarantee that there be equal numbers, as I say, of Democrats and Republicans, and getting people to go find out what it takes to be an election official, election worker. And the I've noticed just in the last couple of weeks, there's this increasing drumbeat. So you heard it here first, that somehow we are manipulating the elections because we are insisting on being there to help count the ballots, hence the name of my podcast, which says to me that that's going to be their excuse somehow, that our efforts to be there and be part of the election apparatus is somehow a negative. But that just says to me, they don't want us to watch them. And I'm just saying we have to be there and we have to watch. But yeah. I was particularly interested in one of the legal arguments and evidentiary arguments that Mark Elias, and let me just back up so people will know, Mark Elias is the lawyer for all the Democrats in the House, all the Democrats in the Senate, all the Democrat committees, all the Democrat state officials, et cetera. And that's been true for a good while. Plus, he received an infusion of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars from George Soros a number of years ago to start running this thing called the Democracy Docket. And he has been become the mouthpiece for attacking those of us who challenged the way in which the election was conducted in certain states in 2020 as regards the presidential election. And, you know, the thing that I've experienced is that somehow there's something wrong with those of us. We're being unpatriotic, we're insurrectionists, if we said that there were problems with the way the election was conducted. And he's been one of the ringleaders and cheerleaders for that narrative. Yet he comes into your district and he argued that the machines didn't work properly and other arguments that he criticizes the rest of us for making, but he made those in your race.
Yeah, unbelievable. I just want to say, to go back on the one thing you did say, is we have a huge problem getting Republicans to fill the slots on election day and the primary day and various and early voting slots. And our Board of Elections says, oh, we can't find anyone. But I meet people all the time who say they would love to do it. And in fact, in one area where we had a lot of issues, and we often do, in the city of Utica, in my district, where, you know, Oneida County had all the problems, there were, I don't know, eight voting districts in there. I think there's 16, actually. And in the entire room, there was one Republican. So there should have been two and two at each one of those places. And we only had one Republican. So that's a big problem. Those two election commissioners, you know, were asked to resign by the governor last year after the poor performance they had. But it wasn't entirely their fault, because it was the pandemic rules that came in at the last minute that Andrew Cuomo created, which it brings me to Mark Elias. I mean, Mark Elias took advantage of these pandemic rules, and so did the Democrats, where the Republicans weren't as on top of this. And we should have been, you know, more on top of it, but we didn't realize what was happening. But it's basically undermining our elections. But yeah, what happened is I was up by 28,200 something votes or 400 something votes. And we got down to the end, and there had been a brief that Mark Elias submitted that said, we don't need a full canvas, you know, of the machines. There's no problem there at all. And we got through to the end. And once we had literally gone through, this is in January, we were registering motor voters, people who had signed up to vote, had filled out the application. The application was transferred to the Board of Elections, but the Board of Elections didn't get the application on the rolls so that they were a registered voter. So the judge ordered the Boards of Election to do that in January. So we were registering voters to count in the 2020 election 2 months later, almost 3 months later. So after that was done, and Elias was sure he had us on that because they were, new voters, probably younger people or people that went to the Board of Elections or the Department of Motor Vehicles. And, you know, which I oppose that, too. We could get into why I think it's all registrations and everything should be focused on the one agency that should be handling that, not universities, as HR1 requires, and among other things. But so I actually pulled ahead and was ahead by a number of votes, over 120 or 30 votes, which, you know, put Elias in a tailspin. So he immediately came forth and said, we need to do a re-canvass of the Dominion voting machines. There were irregularities. They did some phony test that said that because there was a miscount on one batch, the entire election needs to be thrown out. We need to go through and do a Dominion count. And, my top guy on the race, who was Spencer Carr, who was a young kid working with me, you know, I said, go out there and put this is an attempt to undermine an election under all of Mark Elias's tweets and my opponent, which is what they did to President Trump. Mm-hmm. And within a few days, they realized they weren't going to pull ahead and that wasn't going to happen. And we didn't need to worry about that because we already had the counts. You know, what he was advancing was like misinformation again. And so my opponent eventually conceded and that was the end of it. But I mean, this is Elias. He is always sleazy, always trying to, you know, circumvent the law. He's even had, ethics violations brought against him, which went to an appeal. And it was confirmed by 2 out of 3 judges that...
Yes, they imposed sanctions on him for misrepresenting information to the court.
I love the last line of the judge, though, that they suggested that he review the model rules of professional conduct. But this is the guy that all these Democrats attack me on Twitter. He's their savior. He cares about voting rights. He's the most wonderful guy on the planet. He is nothing but a partisan political operative who's trying to turn the election results, totally use our system to create Democratic wins out of losses. And that's all he's doing. And it's completely unethical from a lawyer's standpoint. And you and I are both lawyers. And I'm so glad he got sanctioned. And this should be front page news. But, you know, the left-wing media is never going to talk about it. But we should be talking about this every day.
Well, we should. And, you know, one of the things I don't know if our listeners or audience knows about this, but he announced in a tweet during the Christmas holidays that he was going to start filing lawsuits against members of the House of Representatives who had voted not to certify the electoral votes in 2021 and to claim that they were ineligible, that these House members are ineligible to seek re-election under the post-Civil War Insurrection Act. And what's interesting is that explains to me, I finally realized that's why they've been calling this an insurrection since for the past year, the January 6th activities, because it's really part of laying the groundwork for a legal strategy. And we saw last week that he filed his first lawsuit in North Carolina against Congressman Madison Cawthorn, claiming that he doesn't have he's ineligible to run for re-election. So this is a fight. We have to fight with this very well-funded, hired gun for the left, and that's what he is. And it's a real danger to our system, but we have to contend with it. And I'm glad you brought up the issue of his being sanctioned, because we do need to talk about that. That's a matter of public record. It's not just something that we say. The court has said that. And we need to tell people about it.
Right. But, you know, that's interesting. But when I talk about all those votes that we end up counting, he wanted those votes thrown out. So there were actually 2,400 registrations. And then it turned out there were 400 that actually voted, that actually went to the ballot box or went to go vote at the voting station, got there. They were not deemed as on record because their application had been uploaded then. But the people at the boards took their name down, had them do a provisional ballot, and there were almost 400 of them. Mark Elias went through using their models, whatever they do to look at the voters, and they anticipated that, they picked out 68 or 69. There's a dispute in the legal papers about whether it was 68 or 69. Of those 400, and only those should be counted.
Oh,
not
wow.
Not the 400 that actually voted. So this is another thing he was trying to do. And based on their modeling, what we thought was really interesting is a lot of those people who they thought were their votes actually voted for us. So, you know, you don't know with some of this. And we had local knowledge. We said, here's a guy, he's registered Democrat. we know the region he's from. We kind of can tell where, you know, where he would be voting. And we, lo and behold, you know, our knowledge of our district is what helped us, not necessarily his knowledge. And so I think that that's, you know, another thing is they, this is all just a calculated, cynical effort to really manipulate, you know, elections and really to put Democrats in the driver's seat. And, you know, it's funny because I look at like H.R. 1 and H.R. 4 and Spencer, who's my, you know, my ace staffer here on this, who literally sat in court the entire time while I was in virtual court. We went through this whole thing and he actually suggested, which I thought was pretty funny. I was like, what can you think of as a great analogy? And Spencer said, you know, it's kind of like when you do the coin toss to decide who's going to receive in a football game or who's going to, you know, who's going to kick off first. You know, it's like they all get to make the call, but they also have the coin, which has a heads on both sides, and they make that call. And that's how they want. That's what they call fair. That's what they, you know, that's really
exactly
fair.
Right.
They
that's
don't
a,
want
that's a,
to be
that's
fair.
A good analogy.
They want it completely rigged. He had another, which I thought was funny. It reminded me of the old days. I'm surprised he even knew it. You know, it was kind of like when Tanya Harding, she had that
well, she kneecapped Nancy Kerrigan.
She could win the ice skating as right. We're heading into the Omicron Olympics in Beijing. I thought maybe we'd make an Olympic analogy, but it's the same thing. This isn't about preserving elections. This isn't about freedom. This isn't about fairness. This isn't about, you know, civil rights or voting rights. It's all about ensuring that the Democrats win in spite of their bad policies, which are very unpopular. I mean, voter ID is now polling at over 80% among all groups,
even among minorities.
So this is just nonsense. And even Mark Elias, you know, has made these, you know, I was just going to give you some like some examples of some things that, you know, made some really terrible remarks that I think were somewhat racist, in my opinion. You know, he said in a court that, you know, Mark, he said the racist arguments he's made that, he claims that it's a burden on minority voters to have to educate themselves about the logistical details of a recall election, and that minorities would be burdened by the time it takes to vote, and that minorities were not politically astute enough to understand a recall election.
Wow.
I mean, this is racist comments that undermine people of, you know, of color that have, you know, education and the ability to make decisions. They've all been through our public schools. I mean, this is just an absurdity. And thank God this guy was sanctioned, but this guy is a menace and he's really not about seeking the truth. And I'm glad that you guys are fighting him. And I didn't realize he specifically went after Madison Cawthorn, but that is why they're trying to, suppress the will of the American people. And they're trying to suppress anyone that stands up for election integrity, which is unfortunate because they keep calling me an insurrectionist and I wasn't even in office on January 6th, which was not an insurrection, for goodness sakes.
Well, one of the things I want to turn to is what you've done since you've been in the House this term, and that is founding the Election Integrity Caucus. So tell us about the Election Integrity Caucus and who's in it and what maybe some people will call their congressman after they hear this interview and maybe they'll say, why don't you join the Election Integrity Caucus? But tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you can go and see who's a member of the caucus. I believe we have it up at tenney.house.gov, and it's T-E-N-N-E-Y, just like J.C. Penney with a T. So it's tenney.house.gov, and we put up members who've joined. We urge every member to join. I can't understand why every member of the House isn't, including Democrats, because we aren't doing this in a partisan way. We're just trying to ensure that people have, you know, the right to vote, easy access to voting, to make sure that their vote is private, to make sure that they have no impediments to getting to that vote, and that their vote isn't undermined either by non-citizens voting or by vote trafficking, where more than one vote is put in or somebody's vote is put in and they don't even know it, which is what's happened in New York and around the country. And we just want to be sure that we actually do have election integrity. There could be nothing worse than undermining someone's sacred right to vote. And look, I'm the mother of a Marine. And I, you know, I am so grateful for the service and sacrifice of our military. But think of what they've done for this country. They have served our country. Many have sacrificed life and limb for our sacred right to vote, which is so unique to any other system in the nation, in the world, really. I mean, look, we know Vladimir Putin wins by 98%, the 2% vote against him. That's all just to, you know, so there's some kind of, oh, see, he didn't win unanimously. But we know that Putin knows how everybody votes. We know Xi Jinping knows. And all these bureaucratic tyrants and communists, they know how the people vote. In our elections, we need to make sure it's secure. And by undermining that security really undermines the election. And having these, what Governor Cuomo created in our pandemic election last year was this, you know, online database with no verification. I mean, anyone could go in and take my vote as long as they, and any third party has access, as you know, the Democrats, Republicans, anyone can get access to the voter rolls and find out who voted, when they voted, if they voted in a primary or not. But we don't know how they voted. But if we know somebody hasn't voted in 20 years and we can find a way to get our hands on that ballot, we can turn that ballot in and that person may never know that they actually voted.
And well, that, so and we do think that that happened in many places around the country. And there are a lot of people who are still working on various issues related to 2020. And that's hugely important because we do have to understand the lessons of 2020. But the main thing that we have to do going forward is as we're doing that, we have to look forward and we have to get people engaged. So we've published in November, Congresswoman, at the Election Integrity Network, the Citizen's Guide to Building the Election Integrity Infrastructure. And I'd be happy to share that with the House Election Integrity Caucus. We want everybody. I mean, it is a how-to, simple how-to guide for what citizens can do in their home communities. And we make a very big plea for people to become involved in attending your local election board meetings, becoming election workers, very basic things. But one of the things we have to understand is that the left has infiltrated our election system over the last decade. They've built all kinds of entities with billionaire money from one of the eBay billionaires, Pierre Omidyar. And they've really built an infrastructure that supports massive mail balloting. They have a real investment in that. And my view is that the more I learn about it, the more I realize that voting that takes place out of the purview of the election office and observers, where things can be transparent and everybody can be sure that the rules are being followed, the more votes that are cast outside of that process, the worse it is for ensuring integrity of our elections. And I was very struck by the state of New York, the citizens of New York in November when they rejected those referenda that were put on the ballot by the legislature. Can you talk about that for just a moment?
Yeah, that was like a big win for us. And it gives me hope for the future because these are voting changes that were put through by the Democrat-controlled House and the Democratic governor. So it's one-party rule in Albany. And these voting changes, you know, they were, one of them was to stop partisan gerrymandering. We're in the middle of partisan gerrymandering in New York right now.
And New York is one of the worst.
And the Democrats are, they're not covering up the fact. They're proclaiming that they're going to have partisan gerrymandering and drive every Republican out that they can. And I'm exhibit A for gerrymandering. I had the worst in New York history. So they have been gerrymandering for decades. So when the Democrats try to say, that's something new that the Democrats are going to learn how to gerrymander. Well, absolutely not. So, you know, New York is a 2-to-1 Democrat dominated state. And those ballot initiatives won anywhere from between 55% and 60%, you know, where the upstate vote finally got to eclipse the downstate New York City vote and some of the big city areas. So that was a big win. We also, they also put on the ballot same day voter registration, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like, but you know, the voters completely rejected that. They did not, you know, that was, again, all three initiatives went down. And then we, as we know that 80% of voters still think that voter ID is something that's valid, and we have no voter ID in New York, and they want to go to more and more, you know, direct mail and no voter ID. And it's impossible to do that when you have illegal immigrants are now able to get licenses. HR 1, you know, the number one signature legislation that we all know talk about. HR 1 actually proposes that there is no voter ID, federalizing elections by, you know, allowing also federal funding of campaigns. We came out with a number that I think Chuck Schumer would get $44 million in taxpayer money for his campaign. Nancy Pelosi would get $20 or $30 million for her campaign in one district. And, you know, this is absurdities that are happening. And so this is the kind of stuff that we're fighting. But actually, the people in New York, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, you know, a majority rejected those initiatives. And so they haven't put a New York Republican in statewide office since George Pataki was our governor. So it just shows you that either the trend is turning or there is one thing we can all agree on, that these initiatives coming out of Albany are something that are rejected by the voters. So, you know, that's a good sign. And I think it's a good sign that maybe we could have a Republican governor potentially at this time next year, because people have just had enough. But again, if we don't do something about stopping H.R. 1, you know, which is what I just described, you know, federalizing, disallowing maintenance of voter rolls, taking purge voter, you know, purging voters who haven't voted or moved out of state, allowing voters to shop basically where they want to vote. They might live in New York City, but they might decide they want to vote somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, students vote. There's all kinds of irregularities that are all about just getting as many Democrats wherever they need them to get into tough races. And, you know, that's what a lot of people voted were in my district, had gone to college in my district, were from New York City, hadn't lived in my district in a couple of years, but didn't purge their voter registration in my district, but voted in my district because that's where the votes were needed. They don't need more Democrat votes in New York City. They need them upstate. And that's what, you know, that's like almost like forum shopping for a judge. That's like district shopping or vote shopping. And that's what they're doing as well in New York City. And they're doing that in New York State. So we're trying to fight that off. And then you get to H.R. 4, which would be the takeover of our election system by the Department of Justice. And I'll give you an example of what's happening now. Because of the irregularities in Oneida County, my home county, where those 2,400 motor voter votes didn't get applications, didn't get uploaded, the Department of Justice used its leverage to force our county into signing a consent order. So our county is now run by the Department of Justice under a consent order, and they're overseeing our elections. So you can't tell me the heavy thumb of the partisan left-wing bureaucrats in the Department of Justice, especially that civil division, are in there trying to pressure our Board of Elections. They have no resources to fight against whatever DOJ would tell them to do. So that's, you know, we actually have living proof that H.R. 4 is already working and happening in our district because of that consent order. And
well,
that would
it's a problem because, in fact, my very first guest on my podcast was J. Christian Adams, who's the president and general counsel of the Public Interest Legal Foundation. And he's a former DOJ attorney who worked in the voting section. And the entire episode was really talking about the voting section and the history of the voting section and the lawyers in the voting section of the Department of Justice and how they are all left wing, that they are partisans. And that's what the entire episode is about, and talking about how detrimental that is to ensuring fair elections. And guess what? Just before Christmas, YouTube blocked that episode. It saying that we talked about disinformation about 2020, and yet we didn't even talk about 2020. We were talking about the Department of Justice. So yeah, those tentacles are pretty strong.
Yeah. I mean, J. Christian, he's amazing. I mean, he helped. He was actually consulting. We were consulting with him because I've known him for a while throughout our election, and that, you know, that what I call my odyssey of purgatory and trying to decide who was going to win my election ultimately. But he was very helpful to us, and it was great to have him. So that was terrific. But he has been a real leader on this issue. He's been a great advisor and, you know, very supportive of what his efforts. He's also, you know, come to our election. I think he was one of our first guests we had on the Election Integrity Caucus. You know, Hans von Spakovsky, John Fund, Secretary of State, Democrat from New Hampshire, Bill Gardner.
He's retiring now.
Yeah, he was unfortunately retiring because they're going to probably erase all the good work he's done over the years since 1976.
I know, isn't that
Bill
amazing?
Bill Gardner, he's against all this early voting. He's against all this no-ask absentee voting. He's been tremendous.
Yeah, I wish there were more like him. Well, one of the bills that you've introduced is a bill to ban Zuckerbucks. Can you talk about what you and the House Election Integrity Caucus have been doing or thinking about the private funding of election offices?
Well, obviously, we're coming out. We try to keep our members informed and try to do as many events as we can. We've had a little bit of a hiatus because of the time away from Washington. But, you know, really this whole when we discovered that that Zuckerberg had gotten involved in this race using this 501c3 sort of laundering money through it and into these election districts, and we finally got the 990s from the Center for
Tech and Civic Life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we finally got those 990s and were able to actually do an analysis just to get at the truth. We knew some of it was happening. We've been working with Molly Hemingway and some of the work that she had done in her book. But, it, you know, we're looking and saying, wow, look at all this money to prime the pump, just to take, you know, to really push just enough, maybe a little more than they needed in these key swing state districts where 99% went to electioneering, not to PPE. It was supposed to be 100% to PPE, you know, in the form of buying cars for people in the in these election districts, you know, paying for RVs to go around and pick up, you know, drop boxes, helping the Democracy in the Park in Wisconsin, all these other expenses, and really trying to lure in these voters to get as many Democrats as we could in those key swing states where they knew they could, you know, they could make the difference. And then we found out when they finally filed the 990 that 92% went to those key Democratic swing districts where had there not been Zuckerbucks, they probably wouldn't have had enough votes to overcome the margins they needed to overcome. And using the IRS, I mean, I think back to the days of Obama when they were going after conservative organizations. And now here we are using this 501c3 method where, you know, a billionaire like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, you know, who was able to go through, you know, this outside channel to prime the pump and make sure that Joe Biden was the winner as opposed to. And that affected my race. And we got a bunch of Zuckerbucks into my race and there were key areas where I actually lost. Binghamton got over $100,000, the city of Binghamton, to help, you know, electioneer in that region. And electioneering is really, I think, is illegal. You know, vote harvesting, which is technically illegal, like trying to get votes for people who aren't intending to vote or to, you know, to really push people to vote in a certain way, which is what they were doing with this money. So what I did is, you know, we don't want to federalize elections. I can't emphasize that enough. We all are on board on that. But I wanted to make sure we weren't doing anything on the federal level. But what we were doing is using the IRS to prevent the, you know, them from getting status to be able to do the kind of work that they were doing using this sort of, you know, front organization, not-for-profit for election interference. And so that's really what the End Zuckerbucks Act is all about. Is very similar to what Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has done to end Zuckerbucks and to use the Zuckerbucks in elections. Only this does it on the federal level, so because it prevents the creation of these pass-through, you know, front organizations, these 501c3s that really are just nothing more than just a way to get around, you know, an end run around the IRS and the tax laws. So we're hoping and getting around the federal election laws where, you know, corporations can't give directly to campaigns. So we're hoping that we can get, you know, obviously the Democrats aren't going to touch this right now because they're too busy trying to get H.R. 1 and H.R. 4 passed because they really just want to ensure that they're in power forever. Hopefully if we can take back the majorities and take back the presidency in 2024, we can get this bill passed and really end this kind of interference. It's the worst form of election interference. You know, you talk about election interference. The Democrats talked about it for years. You know, they went on and on about the Russian interference and there was $2 million spent, you know, on a, you know, mostly online on Facebook in an election where billions were spent. And some of that was spent after the election and some of it was spent for Trump and some of it was against Trump. And we indicted 12 Russian nationals, all of whom we couldn't get here to come here, you know, to face their indictment. So, you know, it's all nonsense that all that whole Russia story. So there we go. That was real. The real election interference occurred in 2020.
Well, that's true. And, you know, the thing about it is I'm absolutely convinced. And by the way, I was lawyer for a lot of those Tea Party groups that were targeted by the IRS. So I'm very familiar with all that happened there. I knew for a couple of years something was going on. It ended up being way more than I could ever have imagined. But I just knew that my clients, we were submitting applications that would normally take 3 to 4 weeks, and then it was 2 to 3 years. So, but I will say this, that I've been looking pretty carefully at the expenditures by CTCL and all, and realized that Mark Zuckerberg took a $200 plus million tax deduction for his charitable contribution, that flowed through CTCL. And I'm absolutely persuaded that under the existing tax code, that what they did violates the tax code. And so I'm working on trying to come up with a way that we can pursue that, not having a lot of faith in the Biden IRS. But nonetheless, I think we have to go on record about the illegalities that in which they engaged. Because one of the things that I think is really crucial, and I've been talking to state legislators about this, I think that there should be in the statute something that we take for granted, but which the left has been pushing election officials further and further away from the last several years in the National Association of Secretaries of State and all these national organizations. Election offices, election administrators are there to administer the elections fairly and in accordance with applicable law, and to treat all voters equally and all groups of voters equally. And what the left has been, what the left did with the Zuckerbucks money was that they turned those election administration offices into Democrat turnout machines. That, to me, that should be, that's ultra vires. It's outside the scope of what an election office should do. But I'm glad that, I'm just so glad that the Election Integrity Caucus and you are working on this and are aware of it, and that maybe we can make sure that we put safeguards in place to keep that from ever happening again. Because to me, that was the biggest, that had the biggest impact. We didn't need to have somebody cyber hacking, whatever. They took over the election offices, wrung those Democrat votes out of those key places. And we must never let that happen again.
What's so frustrating about it is technically it's legal. And that's why they're able to create that narrative. Oh, there's just no widespread fraud. You know, the way that they try to dismiss anyone who challenges the
See, I don't think it is legal.
Technically, they were able to pass the law, get away with it. There's no direct violation
There is a provision in the tax code that says that charitable dollars may not be spent in a manner that has the intent or effect of benefiting a particular candidate or political party. And there's case law that says that. I think that it's pretty black and white, but we have to put that before the authorities and we have to hope they'll investigate it.
Right. Well, this is exactly where we are. So we had 990s for a company in 2020, for a not-for-profit that weren't disclosed until December of this year.
Correct.
We were calling, our first letter was sometime last spring demanding those 990s. So we didn't know to the extent what they were doing in terms of the turnout, Democrat turnout machines.
And so,
so now is the time. Now we need to make that case that the intent, when you see 92 and 99%, you can only draw one conclusion from that. And imagine this. I always like to turn this around. Can you imagine if, say, the Koch brothers or Republican operative had actually taken $419 million and plunged it into swing state districts and tried to get Republican turnout.
Their hair would be on fire.
Hair on fire, heads exploding. They'd be absolutely melting down. You know, it's funny. They melt down over the smallest thing. I mean, we get this great new governor of Virginia that gets in and says, I don't want a mask mandate. I want to empower parents. And you would think that every one of these people were the Wicked Witch getting water out of them, all losing their mind. They're just melting all over. It's like, he's not, you know, Glenn Youngkin's, you know, it's like, this is common sense stuff. And the fact that they're overreacting so much is good cause for us to say that they know they're wrong. It's just like Mark Elias overreacting. But I think that, you know, you're right. With the intent on that statute, if we could prove that now that we have the 990s, now that we can show that it was partisan, that it was definitely a turnout machine, there was no equivalent Republican response, because only 8% about 8% went to Republican districts. But how much of that 8% actually went to turning out Republican voters?
Well, that's the difference. That is the difference.
Republican districts where Democrats were turned out, where there might have been a close district that they could push them over. But it was mostly concentrated in swing states and Texas, where they knew in Texas, they were really trying to overturn Texas. you know, to change. They thought that they could turn Texas blue. And so give them credit for trying. I mean, we should be doing everything we can do within the letter of the law to get our voters out and to make sure our voters understand. And I want to go back to something you said in the beginning. Everywhere I go, people ask me about election integrity. And even Democrats and independents, they're very concerned about the erosion of our right to vote. And they don't like the fact that it's all being, you know, politicized to such an extent. And so when you say, you know, you're providing a guide for people, I've had so many people, and I'm so glad you said that, ask me, where do I turn?
What can I do?
Where do I go? I recently spoke to a group of over 1,000 women at the National Federation of Republican Women.
Yes.
Number one issue with this group. And they're like, how do we help? Where do we go? We want to help. We want to be part of this. And by the way, some of them are from Florida. And they said, we know Florida's in good shape. We've got
Wow.
Where can we go? Like, can we go back to my home state, which is blue, and make sure that, you know, votes are counted properly there? So there are a lot of people out there who are good citizens who want to serve. They just need to be inspired and empowered to feel that they can make a difference. And that's really how all of our parties were formed. I mean, I look back and my dad was like a chairman of the Republican Party in our region. And, you know, for him, it wasn't about getting a job for family and friends. It was about how do we advance the cause of freedom, what we stand for and our principles. And, you know, people will rally around you more for that than they will for money or a job. And that's been proven. And so when people really care about something like election integrity, I think showing that we're going to lead the way, regardless of party, we want to make sure that the votes are counted fairly and that it's, you know, we're not disenfranchising anyone, either whether a Democrat or an independent or anyone, you know, of any ilk. So that's the, I think we need to make that case. And I think we are. It's just the media is just shutting us down, big tech shutting us down. You know, and as you said, I mean, I can't believe they censored Christian Adams. You know,
I mean, that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad.
That's really bad.
But I will, our website is www.whoscounting.us. And on our website, there is an electronic version. It can be downloaded. It's the Citizen's Guide to the Election Integrity Infrastructure. And that's what I think we have to have is an infrastructure. We have to have local task forces. And I've just finished last week. I had 3 episodes of the podcast last week and 1 week celebrating the work that citizens did in Virginia in 2021. We had thousands of citizens who were engaged as election workers, as observers, and they got involved in the election process. And I had several of those, 3 of those leaders, citizen leaders, come on and talk about what they did, what they're still doing. So I'm just a big believer in giving people something to do. Don't complain to me. I'm going to give you a task. And so so I really appreciate, Congresswoman, all that you're doing. I want to work with you. I know people will want to be able to follow you. So what's the best way for them to follow you?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Claudia Tenney. I'm on Facebook, you know, same thing, Representative Tenney, Congresswoman Tenney, I think it is. And, or you can, you know, reach out to me at tenney.house.gov, which is my official site. And we put everything out there. I explain every vote in Congress, by the way, too. So
I love that. I noticed that.
We want to make sure we're completely transparent. You know, I'm not in this job for any reason other than I want to save this great country. You know, my grandparents came here as immigrants for a chance at freedom, for a chance at a different life. And it's, you know, this country has changed for the better in some ways, but I'm seeing a decline in what some of our good traditional values that are basic to mankind, not some things that evolve like cultural norms. But I really worry about the fact that this authoritarianism, this growth in the federal government, growth in authoritarian regimes, and things that have been kind of exposed, you know, either by the presidency of Donald Trump or exposed by this pandemic, just to see what the left is trying to do and how dangerous it is to be in a society where the government is controlling our lives and taking our freedom away. Look, I lived in the former Yugoslavia. I was a student at Colgate. I studied there. I ended up working for the Yugoslav consulate before the war in the 80s, during the Olympics, actually, the Winter Olympics in Sarajevo and Bosnia. Wonderful people there, but I know what it's like to live in a system like that. You know, you hear people say, oh, but you know, Tito was a benevolent dictator. Well, guess what? There was an island on the Adriatic Sea where if you were a dissident, that's where they sent you. Your freedoms were taken away, and there are famous dissidents throughout the history, but wonderful people still there trying to come back from the breakup and the tragic war that occurred there. But I know what that's like, and I want to make sure that we don't have anything like that, like Cuba, like Venezuela in our country, that we continue to stand for freedom. We can respectfully disagree on issues, but always advance what our constitutional experiment is, because it's a gift to all of us. And so that's why I'm in this. I'm not going to get any real benefit out of it. I know, like, you look at all these things going on in Congress. I was looking the other day at how much people are worth, you know, when they start and when they're ending. And I look and I go, wow, I've lost money. I think maybe I should look for something, another way to make money someday when I get done trying to save America. But, you know, this is really, you know, a passion of my heart of caring about this country, having a son, you know, serving our nation in the military, and just my parents' just love of our country, imperfect as it may be. But let's strive for a better America. Let's strive to preserve this great a nation that we have, because where are people going to turn if they don't have America? And that's what I hear all the time from my friends around the world, even my friends from the former Yugoslavia, who have found, you know, safe haven here and safe refuge and have built their new lives. So I just think this election issue is so important that the Democrats, the fact that they're trying to destroy it and they're using a diabolical character like Mark Elias to try to undermine our elections, someone who's been sanctioned, someone who has no ethical principles, who's willing to go and undermine our election system is why I'm fighting, because we just can't let someone like that take over and destroy what we already have.
Well, I certainly couldn't say it any better. That's a very eloquent. You've said exactly what I think, that I believe in, what so many, many people in this country, millions of people in this country share those views. And we thank you for all of your hard work. We want to help you any way that you can, that we can, and we'll work with your Election Integrity Caucus, and we welcome any and all of you to join our Election Integrity Network. And that concludes this episode of Who's Counting? We hope that you'll share the episode, you'll subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, download the Citizen's Guide. We have other resources that we post regularly that explain different things that are happening around the country and in Congress and in different states. So remember, it's all about election integrity. And we thank you for joining us on Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. So thank you, Congresswoman. We look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you so much. And thanks for all your great work.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth, because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.